In general, Canadian foreign policy, if we were to give this talk 5 years ago, I think there would have to be a lot of sort of talking laterally. But I think the war in Afghanistan has provided something of clarity to Canadian foreign policy. And I think because of that, I think we can advance beyond that sort of basic narrative that we see now on the news every night and in our newspapers every day, that Canada is indeed fighting in Kandahar in the core element of the counterinsurgency war in Afghanistan. And I want to talk a little bit more about beyond Afghanistan, so both beyond the war itself today and where else Canada is involved in the world, but also sort of after 2011 and this idea that Canadian combat troops are going to be withdrawn from Afghanistan in 2011. And sort of as a peace movement or social justice activists, how do we prepare ourselves strategically over the long term to understand the implications of the changes in Canadian foreign policy? And as Harjab said, this presentation is a result of years of research that I've been working on Canadian foreign policy, as well as on the groundwork that I've done in the Middle East, roughly dividing my time over the last 5 or 8 years. Between the two. And so I really want to, without giving a whole bunch of citations and footnotes, people to understand that the elements that I'm presenting here are primary sources. So these are not people's comments on primary sources, but rather the sources themselves. So the generals, the policymakers, the politicians, and the doctrine writers themselves, this is their words and their projections. And I want to start with sort of the concept that we saw under the Bush administration and following September 11th, the idea of sending expeditionary forces around the world, which became clear after September 11th. And I think there's a tendency sort of in Canada to call those sort of Bush policies. And I think that there's been an opportunity opened up through the election of Obama to see that there's a continuity in these programs, that they're not related to one politician or another, but are major institutional apparatuses that are at play, both within the United States in the Bush-Obama divide, but also here in Canada in terms of the continuity and really consensus between the Liberals and the Conservatives on Canadian foreign policy. And also beyond the politicians themselves, like I said, we're talking about major institutions here. So the Department of Foreign Affairs, the Canadian International Development Agency, the Department of National Defense, these are major bureaucracies that don't change overnight with one election or one minority government or another. So we want to understand that, although there's minor changes, often just in terms of language between the different political parties. We're talking about the apparatuses of foreign policy here, so I want to keep that in mind as well. And the sort of language that's been used in the foreign policy area that we've heard over the last 5 or 8 years has been various terms describing basically the same program, and that is sometimes called the 3Ds, sometimes called the whole of government, and on a military level, it's called the three-block war. But the idea is that the establishment is bringing together the tools of foreign policy: diplomacy, development, and what they call defense. But for our purposes, it's really offense, because when we talk about defense and defensive apparatuses, we're talking about Canadian expeditionary forces. And Rick Hillier sort of brought in, you know, with the sort of straight talking that he brought in when he came, you know, crashed onto the scenes with the quote that the Taliban were the murderous scumbags that were like Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka and these kind of sensationalist phraseologies. But really what Hillier was doing was he was the voice, the face of a paradigm shift in Canada. From this sort of peacekeeping narrative, whether it was ever legitimate or not, we can discuss in the question and answer period. The Department of National Defense says it wasn't legitimate, but we used this narrative of peacekeeping, and then the war in Kandahar, the fact that Canada's on the ground in the core of this counterinsurgency war, in this uprising in southern Afghanistan, which of course has historical roots that go back hundreds and hundreds of years and have done in much bigger and more powerful empires than ours in that area. And so this narrative of the 3Ds, I want to sort of show how it unfolds, not simply in Afghanistan, although Afghanistan is used as if we can use the terminology of a laboratory. And that's what Robert Gates, the defense secretary of the United States, calls Afghanistan. And he says, this is his quote at the United States Institute for Peace just this past fall. He said, "That country has become a laboratory for what I've been talking about for the last year, how to apply and fully integrate the full range of instruments of national power and international cooperation to protect our security and, of course, our vital national interests." So you think about the scale of the complexity of the effort in Afghanistan, and this is the sort of concept that we saw just released for our purposes. It works out well because it was just in the last 2 weeks that both the Pentagon and Obama have released their sort of national security strategies or plans for upcoming, and it was big news. This isn't stuff under the radar like most of our discussions are. This is Obama giving a major speech talking about Afghanistan, of course, primarily, but also the general program that the Americans are going to follow upcoming, and also the defense budget that the Americans just released, which made news for its cuts to what's called conventional warfare, and its switch to what's called irregular warfare, or small wars, or counterinsurgency. These terms are interchangeable. And this even made CBC, NBC, it made the major news that Gates had put through this major shift in Pentagon spending, which is sort of the last of the major bureaucracies to shift. Starting in September 11th, after September 11th, the Bush administration releases its national security strategy, which says that the way to fight these coming wars is to approach them as a global insurgency. And just to sort of define the term insurgency in the way that the Canadians define it, the Canadian Counterinsurgency Manual defines an insurgency as a popular uprising animated by ideas of social change. Okay, so these are the primary definition of insurgency. So, you know, these terms are interchangeable: terrorist, insurgent, thug, criminal. In the terms of Haiti, they pick different terms, but the general idea and to problematize it and to deal with it in terms of doctrine, we're talking about insurgents, people animated by ideas of social change, challenging their governments. Okay, so after September 11th, the United States says the way to approach the world is no longer, empire versus empire, nation versus nation, or army versus army, but rather armies dealing with populations. So it's a shift from armies versus armies to armies versus people. Okay, because the idea is that these countries like Afghanistan and Somalia and South Lebanon, et cetera, they don't have central governments, and so there's not this sort of accountability between the government and the people anymore, and so it's not people fighting in uniforms for the nation, but rather the United States acting as a police officer around the world. And this is, again, embedded in doctrine. This isn't a couple of right-wing thinkers' ideas. This is on the doctrinal level, and as I'll talk about if we have time, but it's also on the procurement level. In other words, this is the kind of military materiel that the Canadians are purchasing. This is the kind of training that the Canadians are doing. This is the kind of shift in the bureaucracy that's happening. It's happening on all levels. And it's premised on this fact that the world has to be approached as a global insurgency. The Americans use the term the long war to describe this latest conflict. So for Canada's purposes, it's important to understand it in terms of that for the previous 50 years, for the Cold War, the dynamic was that Canada's this country of 25 to 30 million people at the time, relatively small compared to the Russians and the Americans, who are preparing in all their doctrine and procurement and training to fight this massive mechanized tank battle in Central Europe. That the Russians are going to come from one side and the Americans are going to come from the other, and up in the air is Tom Cruise, like F-16s, dogfighting with the Soviet. You know, this is the kind of, for 50 years, this is how all the, build more ships, build more missiles, build more fighter jets. Okay, and so September 11th happens, and some dudes with box cutters, $3 box cutters, completely shatter this paradigm because they planned it, supposedly planned it in these failed states where they have safe haven, harbor, these kind of terms. You see how they all dovetail together to create this dynamic that we're living under at the moment right now. And so this idea of the global insurgency is what is animating these policies. And so really, if you only take one thing from this presentation, understand that the foreign policy apparatuses, each and every one of them, defense, diplomacy, development, as well as the RCMP and various other training, Justice Department, police officers, and these types, are all being shifted from this dynamic of armies versus armies to the fact that we're going to be armies versus people, versus populations. And they use these terms, population-centric. The Canadian general, Dennis Thompson, who had just served in as the Kandahar commander in Afghanistan, was just here in Vancouver last week at the Fraser Institute talking about how we're not actually in Afghanistan because of Al-Qaeda. We're there actually to nation build. And so this is the core, right? We're talking from the military straight through to the development apparatus. And it's important. What kind of time are we looking at? Five minutes. It's important to understand this in terms of how we're discussing this in North America and in a Canadian context, because I think it's fair to say that across a vast spectrum of society, the war in Afghanistan is unpopular. And it's entirely possible that in 2011, Canadian combat troops will be withdrawn from Afghanistan. However, it's not going to be because of the success of the peace movement. And this is what we have to understand, so that when we're preparing for the future, we're not constantly reinventing the wheel. We're not constantly, we had all this apparatus prepared to deal with the war in Afghanistan. Well, now that war in 2011, I'm saying, potentially could be really de-escalated. But then Canada's in Somalia. And we have to reinvent ourselves every 5 years as we switch countries. Instead of understanding the idea that the Canadian apparatus is being gauged to fight these wars indefinitely, into the future. And today is Afghanistan, but as General Andrew Leslie, who is the head of the Canadian Army, says, Afghanistan is a model, but it's not the model. Okay, so there's many other models that could fit. And when we see something like the piracy situation in the Gulf of Aden, 3 weeks ago, most Canadians could be forgiven for not even knowing there was pirates in the world. And then, this week, it's front page news on CNN, and there's this big discussion about whether the Americans should actually chase these pirates onshore in Somalia. So you can see how we go from something that's not even in the news to all of a sudden, bam, Canada would be front and center in this land operation to chase pirates into the failed state of Somalia. Boom, Canada's involved in Somalia in 2 weeks, and we can't get a peace movement prepared for all these kind of things if we're dealing with each thing as if it's brand new and it came out of nowhere. And I say this in Somalia because it's not a minor thing. Because Canada, at the moment, although we have forces in Afghanistan, Canada has 21 other distinct military operations being carried out by the Expeditionary Force Command based out of Vancouver Island. 21 other deployments that include a vast array of things from things that Manuel will talk about upcoming, as well as the fact that we have Canadian warships that deploy from Esquimalt into the Arabian Sea. And if people can't see this greatly, but this is just the Arabian Sea. This is a tiny map showing just the Arabian Sea. So we have right here Pakistan, and we have over here Somalia. So it's the ring around the Middle East, okay? So we've had we're on now the 34th naval deployment since 2001 to the Arabian Gulf. If people can look and see where these circles are, they can see where those deployments are. They're all in the exact same area, and they're all right around the areas that are the Gulf of Oman, the Straits of Hormuz, which is the major transit point for Middle East oil, and the Arabian Gulf area in general around here, right down in through the Gulf of Aden. So we have Canadian warships right now off the coast of Somalia where this piracy stuff is happening, okay? And so when they were taking prisoner European and Dutch or Middle Eastern or Russian ships, wasn't that big a deal in North American perspective in terms of what is news. And then all of a sudden the pirates, I think they'll be the first to admit, made a mistake and grabbed what they thought was an international vessel, turned out to be an American vessel, and for the first time since 1804, an American ship had been pirated, and all of a sudden, boom, international news, CNN, Larry King running it all night, you know, permanent coverage of this narrative of should we chase them on shore? And you could watch this happen where Somalia goes from being for sure discussed as a failed state, but now, within 1 week of a news cycle, we're on the edge of invading a country, which Canada, we don't need to tell this audience, has a rich history of involvement in Somalia, in many cases one that shattered the military, you know, the advancement of the post-Cold War military. Because in real terms, it's important to understand what the planners called a strategic paradox of Afghanistan being a laboratory. The strategic paradox is that on the one hand, the war in Afghanistan allows Canada to develop rapidly this expeditionary capability to buy, for example, C-17 cargo jets, these major military cargo jets that can take an entire fighting unit from one place to another in one stop. So when September 11th happens, Canada, the next September 11th, Canada will be one of four nations that will instantly be able to send expeditionary forces to the place where the attack, the safe haven where the attack was begun. Now, that's crucial in understanding the fact that Canada, along with Australia, the UK, and the US, are the only countries with this capability, and that Canada is positioning itself, as I was saying about the previous paradigm of major armies fighting in Central Europe, that paradigm is out, and Canada couldn't well participate in that paradigm, and that's where the peacekeeping narrative comes from, because Canada couldn't deploy a mechanized tank unit to Central Europe with 150, 250 tanks to fight the Russians. We didn't have a big enough army, we didn't have a big enough budget, we didn't have enough factories to build the tanks, but that dynamic is out the window, and now we have this expeditionary civilian-military hybrid-type war where we send Canadian International Development Agency workers to integrate with special forces, the RCMP, and prison guards operating in one unit with 25 or 30 people that then integrate directly into the Afghan apparatus, political apparatus, and become far, far greater than their numbers, far greater than the sum of their parts, because they're integrating right into the unit. So as the Canadians joke, the governor of Kandahar, who we brag so much about this elected government, the Canadians joke that the governor of Kandahar is one guy and two cell phones. And so one guy, two cell phones, and 20 Canadian military advisors. So that's no small thing, and it's the real, the face of Canadian forces going forward. Now, I guess I wish I could talk for 2 hours, but I can't. So I want to just say that the idea is that the doctrine is happening. So on the doctrinal level, Canada is writing doctrine. How do we approach this? This is how the military approaches it. CEDA has overhauled its priorities over the last 5 years to fight, to focus its aid on top strategic priority countries. This is the language they're using. No more sending seeds out all over and hoping some of them grow. Now you steer it to 20 particular countries. You know, some of them are the poorest in Africa, which makes sense in terms of justifying our programs. But of course, the 20 poorest countries get Canadian aid, but Afghanistan gets 70% of our aid, and you know, and Haiti gets a significant portion of the rest of the aid. And of that aid, 70 cents on the dollar is going into a Canadian pocket, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that this whole apparatus, foreign affairs, CEDA, the Department of National Defense, are being restructured, fundamentally restructured, and all these piles are quotes from the generals saying how they're fundamentally restructuring all these forms of all these apparatuses, how the Department of National Defense is actually buying the tools right now to fight these wars, unmanned aerial vehicles bought from Israel, you know, C-17 cargo planes to take an entire expeditionary unit and drop them on the ground ready to fight with their tanks, their helicopters, attack helicopters, helicopters for transport, because we can't drive on the roads of these countries that we occupy, because it's presupposed that the people that are there are going to want to expel us through a series of irregular warfare tactics, such as improvised explosive devices buried in every single possible road that any of these troops will ever drive on. So we now need to buy helicopters, right? And we need to have helicopters, but we can't just have helicopters because the helicopters are sitting ducks for the insurgents. So those helicopters also have to have escort helicopters that have attack capabilities. And as they say, you know, as the cliche goes, when you have a hammer, you know, when your tool is a hammer, you see everything as a nail. And so this is the idea that the entire apparatus is being restructured to fight these wars beyond Afghanistan, beyond 2011, and that in fact in 2011, the withdrawal of combat troops for Canada is what the Canadian military needs and is demanding because they're exhausted, because they have a small army, and this is their first time thrown into the fire. And now they're going to be 8 years of continual counterinsurgency warfare before they withdraw. The Canadian troops are exhausted. They need a break. They need to fix their machines. And so if the peace movement is saying less combat troops, more aid, then the Department of National Defense is saying, Department of National Defense, one, peace movement, nothing, because we're making the argument for them. They want to increase the aid and the development workers, the Canadian civilian apparatus on the ground, while, on the other hand, as we've clearly seen, the Americans, the Leathernecks, the Marines, they're upping their force in Afghanistan, and now Obama's war is Afghanistan. His entire presidency is now tied into the war in Afghanistan. His re-election in 2012, 1 year after 2011, in fact, only a few months after Canadians' combat troops will withdraw, Obama will be running an election campaign saying, look at the success in Afghanistan. And if people think that Canadian planners are going to withdraw their support for Afghanistan just at the moment that it's becoming Obama's war, I think we have another thing coming. So we have a long-term strategic plan to understand Canada as an expeditionary force, both in aid, in development, as well as diplomacy and what we clearly see with the military.
Thanks. Thank you so much.